Turn with me to 1 Samuel 17. Suppose that you are watching a basketball game. That's something people do, apparently, not me in particular, but some people do that. Suppose you are watching a basketball game on TV. I think we all understand the game basketball. There's two teams on the court. In this particular game, there's one team which is full mostly of short and scrawny fellows, playing against a team of mostly strong and tall players. Now, of course, as you would imagine, the Vegas odds are 9.99 to 1 in favor, of course, of the team full of tall, strong players, because no one expects the team full of short, scrawny players to win this game. But to everyone's surprise, though they may be short, this team can jump. And the short, scrawny players, in fact, win the game. Now, it would be very likely in that case that as the announcer is wrapping up the broadcast, he would say something like this. Well, that game was a real David and Goliath story, wasn't it now, guys? Or say there's a political race going on, and one candidate, let's name him Bob. Bob has a lot of experience. He has a good rapport with the constituents in his area. He seems to have a lot of support against him. But there's a new guy. Let's call him Bill. And Bill's a new guy. He's a young guy. He doesn't have the rapport that Bob has. And, of course, it doesn't seem as though he has the same kind of support. But then, of course, they tally the ballots, and you'll never believe it. Bill wins. Now, you wouldn't be surprised at all to read the article the next day about Bill's win over Bob and find that the headline reads as so. David takes office as Goliath takes an unexpected fall. You see, David's defeat of Goliath has become synonymous with any situation where an underdog wins, whether it's in sports or whether it's in politics, whether it's in academics, whatever it is. Which means that as we get into 1 Samuel 17, a chapter that, to be completely honest with you, I was not looking that forward to preaching. I think some might think, man, you just must not be able to wait until 1 Samuel 17. But 1 Samuel 17 has a number of problems for us, not because of the text. The text isn't difficult to understand. The problem is, in fact, the world has conditioned us to understand this text in a particular way. And furthermore, I bet most of you are very familiar with this text. So we're going to have to be quite careful as we look at this text, and we're going to have to make sure we do with this text what we do with every text. And that is, we're going to have to attempt to figure out what the original author, who we don't in fact know, intended for the original recipients, which was Israel, to know. And so we will first seek to understand what the text means, and then, and only then, will we attempt to understand what the text means to us. So let's get into our text. If you were here Wednesday or you got the email, then you know that I am not preaching this entire chapter. I'll preach through verses 1 through 30, and then we'll finish off the chapter next week. This is the word of the Lord, 1 Samuel 17, 1 through 30. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Sakkah, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Sakkah and Azekah in Ephes Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze, and he had bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. give me a man that we may fight together. When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had eight sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The three oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle, and the names of his three sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the third Shammah. David was the youngest. The three eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took his stand morning and evening. And Jesse said to David, his son, take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. See if your brothers are well and bring some token from them. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches, and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. And David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him in the same way, so shall it be done to the man who kills him. Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. And David said, what have I done now? Was it not but a word? And he turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way, and the people answered him again as before. So then, we have just passed a very pivotal point in the narrative of 1 Samuel. You see, Saul still sits on the throne over Israel, but we know that another king has been anointed. Another king will take the throne of Israel. The new king is not Saul's son, as you would think. No, the new king is rather Jesse's son, his youngest son, in fact. God's choice for who would lead Israel next. And when God indicated to Samuel who his choice for the next king was, he made very clear what his choice was based upon. God's choice was based upon the heart of the man, not the outward appearance. So when we come to 1 Samuel 17, in particular the first half, what we find in this half a chapter, one of the things I believe the narrator is doing is setting up a contrast for us between the first king of Israel and the second king of Israel. We are intended to think about the man who is on the throne and compare and contrast him with the man who will be on the throne. So then the one who occupies the throne in Israel is a man without a heart after God's own heart, and the one who will occupy the throne is a man with a heart after God's own heart. There's the contrast. The one who is beginning his rise to the throne is a man with a heart after God's own heart, but the man who is on the throne is not. So as we look at the first 11 verses, we're going to read about the king who is on the throne. And we're going to see how he doesn't have a heart after God's own heart. And then when we look at verses 12 through 30, though it'll just be a little bit, we are going to see a contrast. We're going to see what a man who has a heart after God's own heart is like. And this contrast is going to be most clearly seen in one particular way. The contrast, I believe, is going to be seen in this text in how each man has a different perspective on the enemy that comes against God's people. This is where I believe the contrast will be seen, between how each man has a different perspective on the enemy who comes against Israel. And the enemy, of course, is Goliath. Now, Goliath is not our enemy. We need to be very careful about how we look at this text and how we understand this text. And it's very clear that we don't face Goliath in our life. But we do have enemies. And so we're going to talk about the kind of perspective that we should have on our enemies that we face. But not just that. We'll think about how to have the right perspective on all of life. So as we come to our text, we are reintroduced to Israel's number one enemy, the Philistines. The Philistines are enemies of Israel. They have been opponents of them on the battlefield. And while Israel has other enemies, during the time of the kings, the Philistines are just those enemies that just will not go away. So the Philistines have taken battle position again against Israel, who is led by Saul. All right, Israel is led by Saul right now. Saul is the king who has been rejected by God. He is the king whose God's spirit was recently removed from. He is the king who thus does not trust in the Lord, does not obey the Lord, and does not honor or glorify the Lord. This is the army that the Philistines are up against, Saul's army. An army that we shouldn't expect to succeed, not considering who their commander-in-chief is. So the Philistines have taken battle position. Israel has likewise come out in kind, coming out to meet their opponent. As you heard in the text, there's basically two hills. Each army, one army's on one hill, one army's on another other hill, and there's a valley in between. So the valley is going to be a suitable place for the battle if it takes place, and it is the Valley of Elah. Now, this is where things get interesting, because one of the Philistines descends from the hill on which his army sits. And this, of course, is no regular Philistine. This is one of the Philistines' greatest warriors. And by greatest, I mean the one who looks the most impressive, the one who is the most tall. He rings in at 9 feet 6 inches tall. And he has had much success in battle, as noted by the title the narrator gives him, Goliath the Champion. He wore a bronze helmet on his head. He had a coat of mail weighing 120 pounds, right? Like, some guys only weigh 120 pounds. He wears a coat of mail that weighs 120 pounds on him. That was made of bronze. His leg armor and his javelin on his back were made of bronze. Besides the javelin, he had a sword that we don't read about here, but you do read about in verse 45. And he has a spear with an iron head that weighs 15 pounds. Now, I don't know if you guys, you know, have in your mind like what 15 pounds is like. And so to have something to compare it to, that's equivalent to about 7 of the 4-liter jugs of milk. Okay, 7 of the 4-liter jugs of milk. That's the size of the head on the spear. Just the head on the spear. Now, I don't know how much you know about physics, but if you're going to have a 15-pound head on a spear, that spear is going to have to be very big. And the spear, in fact, is very big compared to a large beam. Then finally, the champion Goliath had a shield the size of a man. And fortunately, he also had a man to hold that shield and walk before him. So it is hard to imagine a taller, more impressive looking warrior than Goliath, which in fact provides a bit of a conundrum for Israel, don't you think? If you recall, Israel had requested a king like the nations, and they had put all their eggs in the basket of Saul, the tallest, most impressive man in Israel. But now they have been confronted by a taller, more impressive man. And we have to be asking ourselves, what are they going to do when they are confronted by such a man? Now, you might be thinking to yourself, you know, I mean, this is not really that big of an issue. He's just one soldier, right? You've got two entire armies. I mean, how much difference is one soldier going to make in a battle between two armies? But in fact, it will make a huge difference, because Goliath steps out from the Philistine camp and he suggests, or I mean, maybe you might say he demands that, in fact, Israel send out a warrior to fight against him, and they'll basically have, instead of army against army, let's just settle this with one man against one man. So he says, listen, I mean, this ain't just for bragging rights. This is for all the marbles. He says, whoever loses will become servants of the winner. So whoever loses is, in fact, giving up their sovereignty. They will no longer be a nation, rule among themselves. They will instead submit themselves to the enemy. Now, Goliath really wants to have this fight. And so he attempts to goad Israel on. He does that beforehand as he comes down and basically implies that they have no business being on the battlefield. After all, he is the Philistine. And if your translation says a Philistine, that's fine. But the Hebrew says the Philistine. So he comes and he says, I'm the Philistine. Like, in other words, I embody all that it is to be a Philistine. And you are nothing but servants of that pesky little bug Saul. Then after he makes his proposal, he makes clear that not only does he not respect Israel, just in case they're not sure, it says he defies the rank of Israel. In other words, he's saying, I heap scorn upon you. He's mocking them. He's shaming them. In other words, this whole speech from the Philistine champion was really a threat, not a gentlemanly proposal. Goliath, the tall and impressive-looking warrior, is looking for some competition in Israel. And I mean, it's not like Israel doesn't have anyone who, from an outward appearance, qualifies to fight this battle. I mean, Israel's king is the tallest and most impressive looking man in all of Israel. And if you recall, this is the very situation for which Israel requested a king. They said, we want a king, and I quote, to go out before us and fight our battles. This is what they wanted. This was Saul's time to shine. This was Saul's open door to step up. He was the perfect man for this battle. And you have to imagine that if he had risen to defeat Goliath, he would have been lauded and praised by the people of Israel as the king he was supposed to be. But instead, along with all of Israel, it says that Saul and his army were dismayed and afraid. I mean, you have to wonder what happened to Saul's courage. Why is he terrified and void of hope in the face of this enemy? Well, in light of the context in which this ordeal takes place, I think it's because, as we have recently learned, God had rejected Saul as king. I think it's because God had removed his spirit from Saul. I think it's because Saul did not have a heart after God's own heart. So then the opening of the David and Goliath story then is a reminder of something that we learned a few weeks ago. And it is that we should be concerned with what God is concerned about. Namely, we should be concerned about the heart. Saul, a tall and impressive looking man, is afraid and dismayed when confronted by his enemy, another tall and impressive looking man. And the reason for that is, as I said, the king of Israel did not have the spirit of God and thus did not have a heart after God's own heart. So what the first 11 verses of our text teach us, I believe, is that without the spirit of God and without a heart after God's own heart, we will not have a right perspective on life and, more particularly, a right perspective on our enemies. Saul then is a shining example of what not to be and what not to do. He did not have a heart which trusts God or a heart which loves God. He did not have a heart which relies on the work of God in his life. He did not have a heart which obeys God. He did not have a heart which wanted above all to see God honored and glorified in all things. And when we have that kind of heart, when we do not trust in God and rely on his spirit at work in us, we will not see our enemies rightly, just like Saul didn't. We will instead live a frightened and worrisome life, like Saul did, instead of rising to the challenge and living for God by the power of God for the glory of God. Now, on that note, now that we have the negative example, the narrator has someone he wants you to meet, someone he wants to contrast with Saul, Israel's current king. So as we get back to the battlefield, you've got Saul on one side, scared and afraid, not trusting in God, and you've got Goliath on the other side, with contempt for God's people and thus for God. And at this point in the narrative, right when you think things are heating up on the battlefield, the narrator says, now hold on a minute here. There's someone we need to check up on. It's like he takes his gaze from the battlefield to Bethlehem. He's talking about Saul, and then immediately he is now talking about David. Remember David, the narrator says. He is that shepherd boy, that youngest son of Jesse, who was recently anointed as king. And he is that one who the Spirit of God recently rushed upon. And it's right at this point in the narrative, right when things are heating up at the battlefield, that the narrative says, I need you to think about David for a minute here. So let's think about David for a minute here while Goliath has Saul shaking in his boots. Before the narrator says much about David, he reminds us that David has seven brothers. Seven brothers, but only three of them were in the Israelite army at the time. It was the three oldest brothers. Now, if you recall, David had been hired by Saul to be a lyre player and also to be an armor bearer. And David would travel back and forth to his father's home because he was the youngest of the family and as such had to care for the sheep. And so he would travel home and care for the sheep, and then he would go when Saul needed him to play the lyre. And it appears that David has not been back and forth for about a month and a half. 40 days, to be exact, because it seems as though he doesn't know about this brouhaha that's going on between the Philistines and the Israelite army. 40 days this has been going on. 40 days of regular taunting from Goliath. For 40 days, day and night, twice a day, Goliath would descend from the Philistine hill to present his proposal for a duel. For 40 days, Goliath would flex his muscles and fling mockery and shame at the Israelite army twice a day. For 40 days, twice a day, Goliath would expose Saul's cowardice and fear. So nothing has really happened between the two armies. They're still there, each on their hill. They still daily take battle position. And Goliath continues to wait for Israel to present a warrior to fight him. Now, as you can imagine, Jesse is a little bit worried about his sons in the military, right? They don't have social media or any kind of way to keep in touch except to send a messenger to get word. And so Jesse decides to send his son, David. You got to wonder, why didn't he send one of the other sons? There's three other sons at home. No, he decides to send David. You'd almost think it was as though David was meant to be there. So he also sends provisions of grain, bread, and cheese. And man, I tell you, that cheese just intrigues me. Did you notice how many cheeses they took? Like, I think it's like 10. I don't know. I just want to know about that cheese. It just intrigues me. I mean, the grain and everything, that makes sense. But he took 10 cheeses. Anyway, I'm sorry. I know I'm a little weird, but that just seems like a detail, you know, like, also, take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. You almost wonder why that had to be in there, don't you? I mean, you can't miss the fact that this whole chapter is filled with details. Like, so many intricate details that you wouldn't think are necessary. But clearly, like, the narrator of 1 Samuel has clearly slowed down here at chapter 17 and trying to draw us into this narrative with these details. I mean, they're not just... details that don't matter. All these details matter. They all paint this picture for us. So Jesse sends David to be a mere messenger, a common courier. The one who was just anointed as king is just a messenger and a courier now. And he makes the journey from Bethlehem to the Valley of Elah. As he arrives, what has happened for the last 40 days happens again. It says in verse 19, the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry, and Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. They had done this every day for 40 days. This would be day 41. So David quickly drops off the provisions he brought with the supply keeper, and then he goes to the armies and greets his brothers. And I just think that's really interesting as well. Because do you remember where Saul was when they called him to be king? He was hiding among the supplies. David gets to the camp. He can't hang out with the supplies for 5 seconds. He's got to get right to the battlefield to find out what's going on. So he goes, he finds his brother. He presumably passes on the message from their father to say that he was concerned, Jesse's concerned about them and wants to take a message back to his father about the well-being of his brothers. While David is talking to his brothers, Goliath comes out and does what he has done for 40 days. He steps forward from the Philistine army, presents his challenge that Israel would send out a warrior to fight him, tells whoever loses their side loses and submits to the authority of the other side. Well, this apparently is the first time that David has heard of this. He wants to know what's going on. And so before it gets to that, though, I think it's really interesting that there in verse 24, right? It says, verse 23, as he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistine and spoke the same word as before, and David heard him. And then the narrator inserts again something we already know again, but just so you remember, all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. Like that had happened for 40 days. So David hears about Goliath, and just so we don't forget, all the men of Israel are a bunch of fraidy babies. So you got to think, in verse 24, that is a very condemning statement, don't you think? It does not say some of the men of Israel. It does not say most of the men of Israel. It says all of the men of Israel. All of them were dismayed and afraid, were much afraid. All of the men of Israel, which included Saul. Do you remember what Saul did when he was anointed as king? The first thing he did, he wiped out Nahash and the Ammonites. Remember that? All the men of Israel. Now, that included Jonathan. Do you remember what Jonathan did? He took down 20 men with just his armor bearer and one sword between the two of them. All of the men, which included Abner, who was the commander of Saul's army, all of the men of Israel were afraid, and none would accept Goliath's challenge, even though the reward for such a task was no small reward. The man who would take down Goliath would receive great riches. He would receive a bride, and his family would be free, which is to say, never have to pay taxes again. I mean, come on now. I'm ready to take on Goliath. I don't have to pay taxes ever again. So David hears about this. I mean, you know, your ears got to perk up when you hear something like that. And he asks again, like, what is going to be done for the one who defeats Goliath? And they repeat for him. Now, at this point, Eliab is a typical older brother. He's not happy about David's inquisition. And verse 28, quite angrily, he says, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. Now, there is two things that are wrong with Eliab's comments here. The first concerns the sheep. Like, what's he on about the sheep? He says, with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? First of all, let's consider the fact that David had been appointed as a lyre player and an armor bearer for Saul, but he's still taking care of the sheep. Like, I think he probably could have convinced Jesse to let him off the hook for the sheep. There were still three other brothers at home. But no, David still takes care of the sheep. Second of all, why are they all of a sudden in the wilderness? Like, what is he talking about? It's as though he thinks that the sheep have taken off from the farm. I don't know why he says they're in the wilderness except to heap shame upon him. And why does he say few sheep? I don't know. But clearly, he's trying to make David feel bad. The first problem is what he says about the sheep. But the second problem is worse than what he says about the sheep. And it's that he professes to know something that only God knows. He professes to know what is in David's heart. Now, we've talked about this some lately, but I just want to repeat, you don't know what is in anybody's heart. I do not know what is in anybody's heart. We cannot see the heart. There's a lot of people that I have thought, maybe not a lot, but a few people in my life that I thought were the best of my friends, and it became very clear that they weren't. I thought I saw their heart. There's been other ways around where I look at somebody, I think, man, something is wrong with that person. But I always acknowledge, I don't know that person's heart. We can't see it. Now, that shouldn't stop us from trying to assess a person's heart, right? Because the scriptures teach us very clearly that what is in the heart comes out, right? So, you know, we see the fruit, and that generally reveals the root. So we should still seek to know what's in a person's heart, but we should never attempt to declare definitively that we know a person's heart, because we don't. But Eliab says that he says, I know your presumption and I know the evil of your heart. David, he doesn't get drawn into an argument here. He just says, you know, like basically he's saying, look, I just asked a question. I just wanted to know what's going on. And then he goes back to discussing the situation with others concerning Goliath. So that's where we're going to leave our narrative today. Now, we're not done yet. Don't think I'm saying we're done. We're not done. We still got work to do here. There is something which David says in our text which indicates that though Eliab thought the worst of him, David is in fact the only Israelite thinking right about this situation. David is the only one who has a proper perspective on Israel's enemy, Goliath. And this is demonstrated by one thing. Look with me at verse 26. I mean, there's not a lot here, but this one little bit is enough. It says, "And David said to the men who stood by him, 'What shall be done for the man who kills the Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?'" So without even getting into what is about to transpire, I mean, you all know, we haven't even got into the exciting stuff yet. But without getting into what is going to happen between David and Goliath, and even though we know that it's going to take a while for David to eventually take the throne, we have got to know right now that things are looking up for Israel because David is going to be their king. The Spirit of God was present upon David because the Spirit had rushed upon him. The Spirit had rushed upon David because God had anointed him to be king. And God anointed David to be king because he had a heart after God's own heart and thus was trusting in God and living for God by God's power and for God's glory. And we see this, all of that, just by how he identifies Goliath as the uncircumcised Philistine, which is not to make a comment about his physical, I don't even know how to say it. You know what I'm getting at here. That wasn't the point. If he was an uncircumcised Philistine, it was to say that he wasn't a member of God's covenant people. He was outside of the covenant people of God. And if you are outside of the covenant people of God, then you are an enemy of God, an opponent of God and his people. David comes in and he clearly sees this man is outside the covenant of God and as such is an enemy of God, bringing reproach upon God and his people. And then we also know about David and his heart after God's own heart by how he defines what Goliath is doing. He is defying God's army. You see, the first 11 verses, you don't hear anything about God. It's all about Saul and Saul's army. But when David comes in, he's like, no, Goliath is not coming against Saul's army. Goliath is coming against God's army, the living God. And clearly David thinks that is a terrible idea. You know, we don't learn a ton from David, as I said, in today's text. The contrast is just only being set up. But I think we learn enough to know that it takes a heart after God's own heart to have a right perspective on life in this world, and more particularly, a right perspective on our enemies. Which brings us just a little closer to the end of this sermon, but not quite to the end. There is something which we need to discuss before we get to the end. Namely, we need to discuss who or what are our enemies. And then what is the perspective that we should have on them? I think we find this answer as we consider what Goliath was all about. What was Goliath all about? Goliath was in opposition to God and his people. Goliath was their enemy. Goliath wanted to see their demise. So who is in opposition to God's people now? Who wants to see our demise? Who or what is our enemy? Well, obviously, and I do mean obviously, there is that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. Both Peter and James warn us about his desire to devour us. Then there is sin crouching at the door, which Paul repeatedly tells us is an enemy. And then finally, there is the last enemy, namely death. Now, I don't know about you, but in comparison to those armies, or those enemies, I should say, I should think we would want to fight Goliath. I mean, we have enemies that are much worse than Goliath, no matter how bad Goliath looked. But not to worry. Not to worry. Not to worry if you have the Spirit of God and thus have a heart after God's own heart. Because you can have a right perspective on your enemies. If you have been chosen by God to be set apart to God, if you have been redeemed by God and thus adopted as a child of God, if you have been regenerated and indwelt by the Spirit of God to live for God, to the glory of God, you can trust God and thus have a right perspective on all of life and in particular on our enemies, which is to say you have no need to be afraid or dismayed of your enemies, no need whatsoever. Let's talk about that. First, there is Satan. What are we to think of Satan? Well, Satan is a defeated enemy. He's a defeated enemy. Now, yes, he still remains with influence in this world, but you must know that God has defeated Satan once and for all at the cross, and then he bound him in Hades until which time he will set him free. You might think, whoa, he's going to set him free? Yes, he's going to set him free. This has not happened yet, but the Apostle John saw a vision and recorded it for us, and thus we know with certainty that when he is set free, and I quote, the devil will be thrown into the lake of fire and sulfur where he will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Yes, while he is bound right now, he is influenced by proxy in this world, which is to say he has a band of wicked angels working on his behalf because he still wants to see us devoured, but he is defeated. And furthermore, he and his demons can only do what God permits. So while we most definitely need to be aware of and on guard against our enemy Satan, we do not need to be afraid or dismayed by him. Then there is sin. Sin is another enemy that we must be aware of and we must be on guard against because, as Paul tells us, we must fight against sin. The reality is that until Christ returns or calls you home, if you are a child of God, you will be confronted by this enemy. This enemy is always crouching at your door. But you need not fear or be dismayed, because the good news is that this enemy, like Satan, has been defeated. And so we, as people of God, in God's army, fight from victory, not for victory. You see, our victory is in Jesus. Because of the cross, Paul tells us, sin cannot condemn us. And because we have the Spirit, we have the power of God to resist sin and put sin to death. So we not need be afraid of sin and temptation. Sin and temptation best be afraid of us. We have the power to murder it because we are in union with Christ and indwelt by the Holy Spirit. Then finally, there is the last enemy, death. And the good news is that Jesus died and defeated death when he rose again, breaking out of the grave alive and will. And because of Christ's resurrection, we will die, likely, before Christ returns. Not necessarily, but likely, we will die before Christ returns. But I'm here to tell you, you have no need to fear death. No need to be dismayed by death. Because death is only the vehicle through which we come into the presence of God. And wait until Christ rises our bodies from the grave and reunites our bodies with our souls, at which time we will live forever and ever in the presence of God in the new heavens and the new earth. So we have nothing to be afraid of. If we have the Spirit of God within us and we have hearts after God's own heart, we have nothing to fear. If you have repented of your sins and trusted in Jesus Christ, then you have a heart after God's own heart. But you need to know that God didn't give you that heart because you deserve it. You didn't deserve it. None of us deserved it. It was all of God's grace. He chose you to be one of his children, to be in covenant with him. He then defeated your enemies through his death and resurrection. And then finally, God provided you with the power of his Spirit to trust in him and live for his glory. God did all that for you, for his people, so that we do not need to live a life of fear and worry like Saul, but rather we can have a right perspective on all of life and more particularly on our enemies, just like David did.